So I'm Mark Rabinowitz, author of Peak Choice, Cooperation, or Collapse. And just to start, that's the energy system that I used to prepare the presentation. And all of these graphics I will be posting at peakchoice.org. This photo, I think everyone has seen, it's from the Apollo 8 mission, which was the first to circle the moon, although they didn't land. Seeing the Earth floating in space in the vastness of the cosmos is probably the most important paradigm shift in the history of the species, at least as important as recognizing that the Earth was not the center of the solar system. The mountain that some people call Everest is the highest land mass on the planet, 29,000 feet, 8,800 meters. If you go up to the top, you can't breathe, and people don't stay there very long. Jets fly even higher. The point for mentioning this is the atmosphere is a very thin film that ensures that life can continue. Whatever we all do, whatever we admit, whatever life support systems we allow to remain intact, they all have to exist in this narrow margin. The most important question facing the human race is how we're going to respond to the interconnected crises of peak oil, climate change, overpopulation, overconsumption. How do you want to use the rest of the oil? For more solar panels or more battleships? For Walmart or relocalizing food? Everything else in this presentation is a detail. Why have we not gotten there? What would it take to make these shifts? We're in a paradox. If we don't keep our civilization fueled, it will collapse, probably with a global war over resources. But if we keep doing what we're doing, it will destroy the life support systems of the planet. Peak scenarios. David Holmgren was the co-originator of permaculture, and one of his books is called Future Scenarios. It's very short. It's even on his website, futurescenarios.org. And it's the best summary I've come across of the need to connect peak oil and climate change together. Focusing on energy shortage without dealing with climate has led to the false solutions of tar sands, offshore drilling, mountaintop removal, liquid natural gas, fracking for shale gas, and nuclear power. But focusing on climate while ignoring energy is one of the reasons for the political backlash against climate change awareness. Most of the climate-only movement is framed as we should reduce energy consumption instead of we will reduce consumption because you cannot burn fuel that does not exist. The choice for civilization is essentially between permaculture for 9 billion people, a best-case scenario, and a militaristic approach involving rationing and more conflict. Richard Heinberg, in his book Power Down, calls this the last man standing scenario, and it is what the United States government and other governments and transnational corporations have chosen. A different way to look at scenarios is from the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. On the vertical axes, whether the transition time will be gradual or abrupt, and on the horizontal line, whether the transition will be well-managed or chaotic. The scenarios range from a sustainable world economy, agrarian social democracy through corporate states, resource wars, and even nuclear Armageddon, if the chaos is chaotic and abrupt. The story of the Titanic shows the futility of arrogance and the need to have an equitable approach to the disaster. One of the side stories of Titanic is the poorer people on board were locked below decks when they realized there were not enough lifeboats to go around. Supporters of the endless growth paradigm suggest that economic growth will take care of poverty. A rising tide lifts all yachts. But if growth is ending due to resource constraints, then pressure for a different economic paradigm to increase sustainability will be even more difficult. How do we share a smaller pie more equitably? How do we build lifeboats that allow everyone to survive? Easter Island is an example of a society that went crazy as their natural resources disappeared. That society clear-cut their forests, and as their life support system went away, they engaged in flashier displays of wealth, such as the giant head statues that are very famous. When the forests were gone, they couldn't make canoes anymore to go fishing, and the society devolved into cannibalism since they couldn't go fishing in the ocean anymore. When the Europeans arrived a few centuries later, the survivors couldn't remember what happened. And I would suggest our skyscrapers are the equivalent of the giant stone heads will the skyscrapers be the Angkor Wat of the 22nd century? The responses are fractal. They can be scaled from the personal, family, and neighborhood levels to the bioregional and global levels. It's a false choice to wonder which level is the most important. All of these and more are needed. Different people have different talents. No one can address all of them. It helps to have local familiarity with growing food or reducing energy consumption to be effective at larger scales. And the graphic shows the different zones and sectors for planet Earth, the different energy, food, water, population, democracy, health, economy, transport, the local, bioregional, and global levels in concentric circles. Binary thinking makes computers work, but is not good for understanding complexities. This sign is on the Dallas Morning News building, and it says, "Build the news upon the rock of truth and righteousness. Conduct it always upon the lines of fairness and integrity, and acknowledge the right of the people to get from the newspaper both sides of every important question." As if there's only two sides to any question. And you can't see it with the projector here, but at the bottom it's signed by George Dealey, who owned the paper, and it's a couple blocks away from a famous plaza named after him. My political map details a psychological pattern used to manipulate perceptions, a two-front war for truth. The corporate media promotes the official story on the left. Next, there is the fallback position, sometimes called a limited hangout, where some of the truth is let out, but in a way that the full truth is covered up, which is a lie. The alternative media, so-called, mostly focus on secondary issues and limited hangouts, not root causes. At the other end of the spectrum is deliberate disinformation that can be designed to discredit looking deeper beyond the official story and or limited hangouts. These can be dismissed as so-called conspiracy theories, although most of them have bits of truth mixed together with nonsense, mirror image of incompetence theories. For most issues, the best evidence is difficult to find through these distractions. The psychologist Maslow suggested that humans have a hierarchy of needs. Without the basics of survival, it is difficult to focus on abstract culture. The dominant paradigm teaches that money is the most important value, and energy conservation and ecological sanity are nice if we can afford them. Most of the environmental movement has embraced the concept of triple bottom line, which suggests that the economy needs to consider ecology and social justice issues. While it's good to focus on these economic decisions, the deeper truth is that the environment makes the economy possible. Energy creates money, not the other way around. And for disinformation, it's probably not a coincidence that many of the political voices calling attention to the problems of fiat currency, the Federal Reserve, and other structural problems rarely mention underlying ecological limits. And worse, some of them are fixated on Jewish bankers who supposedly run the world. We need to weave together advocates for social justice with understanding of how money is created and that we've reached the limits to growth on a finite planet. And here's the math of exponential growth. If you have a jar of yeast, and the yeast doubles every minute, and it takes an hour, 60 minutes, for the yeast to fill the jar. When is the jar half full of yeast? 59 minutes. So if you had some yeast, say about 5 minutes before the hour was up, saying, "Hey, we're starting to get full." And the other yeast will go, "No, we're only at a couple percent full. We have plenty of time." That's the math of exponential growth. And are we smarter than yeast? And that is the mathematics of how money is created, through exponential growth, through compound interest. The responses to ecocide often resemble the parable of the blind men and the elephant. Each is touching part of the elephant, but none see the big picture. We need to connect the dots between peak energy, climate change, renewable resource depletion, finite resource depletion, overpopulation, overconsumption, and financial crash. The climate movement has rallied behind the demand to cut carbon by 2050, spurred by the understanding that you don't need a weatherman to know the climate is changing. But something in this makes me feel like I'm in an upside-down world, Alice in the Global Warming Wonderland. How many politicians being asked to support this slogan will still be in office in 2050? How many of us will still be alive in 2050? Who came up with this slogan? This is a chart from the Oregon Department of Transportation on their plans to reduce carbon emissions by 2050. I think it's a subtle way to acknowledge that the fossil fuels will be mostly over by then. There's not enough fossil fuel remaining to have endless increase in carbon emissions, but there is enough to further pollute the atmosphere. The chart on the left is a Department of Energy estimate of the decline of world oil supplies by 2030, which they estimate will be roughly half of what they are today. Unidentified projects, the gap between growth and decline, is a euphemism for we would like to use more energy, but even the unconventional sources such as tar sands and fracking are not going to keep up with demand. On the right is a chart that shows North American oil consumption over the last almost decade, and it's dropped about 10%, not because of environmental proactive policies, but because as the price went up, people used less. This chart from the Department of Energy is complex but simple. It shows where each major energy source is used. So this is electricity, home use, industrial use, and transportation. The green here is petroleum, which is almost entirely used for transportation and almost none for electricity. The big black line is coal, and almost all the coal is for electricity. There's none for transportation because we don't use coal trains anymore. And there's a little bit used for industry, and that's mostly for steel. Red is nuclear, and that's all for electricity. The blue line are the dams for hydroelectricity. This is natural gas. Natural gas goes for electricity, to heat homes, industry. And on the right side, you have useful energy, which is things we want, and lost energy, which is inefficiency. So as these supplies decline, efficiency will help in the short run mitigate the impact of the decline of the sources. The purple line is biomass, solar, and wind, which is a thin line compared to the thicker lines of the fossil fuels and the nuclear. On a per capita basis, peak energy globally was reached in 1979. And if industrial civilization does not figure out how to survive and thrive without the fossil fuel, then technological civilization will be a short blip. Here you have Australopithecine, here you have Neil Armstrong, and here you have Permaculture Man 3000 AD. Now, I've been using solar power for over 20 years, and I would love for renewable energy to have the potential to replace the fossil fuel. These are two of the efforts that have probably gotten the most attention in the last couple of years. This is a study from Stanford, which was profiled in Scientific American, saying we could replace all the fossil fuels with renewables by 2030. This is Arjun Makajani on the right, and Paul has it for sale in his bookstore, carbon-free and nuclear-free, which says we could do it by 2050. And these are both wonderful studies, except they don't factor in it takes fossil fuels to make renewable energy systems. My kilowatt of solar panels took fossil fuels to make and then transport across the continent, across time zones. And we should have done this a few decades ago to really make the shift. And actually, at a website called The Oil Drum, they did a very nice deconstruction of this report saying that, well, we love the ethics of it, but the math doesn't quite add up. I'd be happy to have that discussion afterwards. So this is a graphic from Charles Hall at the State University of New York about energy return on investment, sometimes called net energy. It takes energy to get energy out. We used to get 100 units of oil out of the ground for every one unit that we put in, because most oil wells require a pump to physically lift the oil out of the ground and then move the oil to the refinery and then cook the oil and then move the refined products to your local gas station or whatever airport, etc., Amtrak depot. But now the oil is much less energy dense because we've picked the low-hanging fruit. Coal is pretty energy dense, natural gas a little bit less. This is solar electricity down here. You do get more energy out than it takes to put in, but you have to use it for a couple of decades. And one other thing about the chart is the entire U.S. energy consumption, according to Dr. Hall, uses more energy than the photosynthesis that we can capture. It is not physically possible to replace all of the energy we use with biomass, even if the biomass is done relatively sustainably, which of course it's not.
Clarifying question.
Sure.
You have to use your solar photovoltaic panels for decades before they've generated more than it took to make them?
There's a huge argument over the exact amount of time. You also have to factor in minerals, and some of the minerals are rather exotic. And then you also have to factor in the inverters and the control equipment and the wire. I look at this as a guide rather than a precise calculation, because I don't think it's possible to do a precise calculation.
Another clarifying question. A person said that the amount of energy used by the U.S. is larger than all the photosynthesis that happens within the borders of the U.S.?
Think of a tree. A tree captures a lot of solar energy, but it's only about 2% efficient. And unless we were to liquidate every standing tree, there's no way. I mean, look at the controversy over corn for ethanol, which I assume people here are familiar with. That's replacing a tiny percent of the oil that we're using. And we're using something like a third of the corn, a quarter of the corn, somewhere in that range. I forget the statistic off the top of my head. To replace just the tiniest amount of the oil that we're using. If we took all the corn and turned it into oil, it would make very little impact on our oil consumption. So, in 2004, National Geographic ran this End of Cheap Oil cover story. The Washington Beltway is on the picture. Here's the Rancho Seco nuclear power station, now closed, near Sacramento. There's a large solar array in the foreground there. To repeat what I just said, solar panels, wind turbines, and other systems require energy to make. This is the oil that was used from 1950 to 2025. Oil before and oil for the grandkids. That's what will be left. The only debate about peak oil is the timing. From a long-term perspective, it doesn't matter whose predictions are correct. Because a child that was born in 1990 will see the end of the oil era. Do people know who M. King Hubbert was? M. King Hubbert was a geologist who came up with the model for how oil fields decline. And I have a two-minute video of his.
Now, to this complete cycle for the world, to give you a time scale on that, bear in mind that started in 1857. And so here's where we were about 3 or 4 years ago. This was proved reserves in the air, which would add up to about here. And the estimated peak would occur about 1995, and we go into this climb. That middle 80% again. It has spread from the 60s, the late 60s, up to a little over 20, beyond 2020. First computed out here about 56 years. Mm-hmm. That assumes an order of evolution. That says that a child born, say, within the last 10 years, will probably see the world consume most of its oil if he lives a normal life.
Yeah.
Now, their OPEC countries are tampering with this curve right now. They're actually curtailing production somewhat. Mm-hmm. And so it's conceivable that this peak up here might be shifted over to the back side a little bit. We might cut off this rate of growth and stabilize. If we did, that would extend this 180% by about something like 10 years. But it doesn't alter the basic thing that I'm saying significantly. To appreciate again the situation of our modern industrial society is contrasted, say, with the past future with regard to the fossil fuels, to appreciate the fossil fuels in the human history. I've taken this time span here from 5,000 years ago to the present to 5,000 years in the future. Now, what we call recorded history began about 5,000 years ago. So what this shows is that this quasi monument-like spike here is the episode of the fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, and every other kind of fossil fuel in human history. Mm. It's the most disturbing thing that's ever happened to the human species. It's responsible for our technological society, and in terms of human history, it's a very brief epoch.
So we can't use fuel that we haven't found. The peak of global oil production was around 1962, and the two curves have to be the same size. Here's another way of looking at it. And yet another. We've used the traditional oil that was easy and cheap. And now on the downslope will be the no longer low-hanging fruit, the more difficult and expensive oil. Four key facts. The oil will take decades to run out. No prediction will be correct. The issue is when supply no longer keeps up with demand, not when it runs out. And after peak oil, the OPEC countries in the Middle East will have most of what's left. Here is a map of the world. Each country is sized by the size of their oil reserves. Here's the United States, Canada, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, which is very tiny as a landmass, but that's where the oil is. This map is from BP. So these show the oil and gas reserves of the largest oil companies in the world. The first about 15 are national governments. So you have Iran, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. Exxon is this one down here. You have BP, Chevron, etc. So the big oil companies that we all love to hate are not the big players anymore. And this shows that the oil in the Middle East is actually in a very small area. This is the Arabian Peninsula. There's no oil on the west side. This is where Mecca and Medina, the holy cities of Islam, are. But there's no oil over there because it's volcanic. It's the wrong geology. In the 1980s, the different OPEC countries had a bidding war where they all increased their proved estimates of how much they have left, because the more oil reserves you had, the more rights within OPEC you had to export oil. And they need to export the oil to fund their societies. That's their entire economy. Here's a clearer map of it that shows that they all increased their reserves, the different Gulf countries, yet all their large oil fields, for the most part, were found in the 1940s and 1950s. The world's largest oil field is Ghawar in eastern Saudi Arabia, and it was found in 1948. Iraq has oil fields in the north, in the Kurdish area, and in the south, near Basra, which is majority Shia. The U.S., both Mr. Cheney and Mr. Biden, have been promoting the idea of breaking up Iraq into three new countries. So the Kurds would have oil, the Shia would have oil, but the Sunnis around Baghdad would not have oil. And that's part of the reason for the conflict. Iran is an even more multi-ethnic society. Each of these colors represent different ethnicities. And the dots are the oil and gas fields, which are all along this ridge. Some's in Iraq, some's in Iran. There's a geologic formation here, which is where all the oil is. Most of the rest of the country of Iran does not have oil. Tehran is up here. This green shows the Arab minority part of Iran, since Iran is not a majority Arab country. It's Persian. And this is what Saddam Hussein was trying to get when he invaded Iran with U.S. blessing in 1980. Because if he took the majority Arab part of Iran and added it to Iraq, Iran would lose most of its oil supply. In 2006, a U.S. colonel named Ralph Peters published this map in Armed Forces Journal magazine, which is not everyone's favorite reading material, but it showed splitting Iraq into three new countries, splitting Iran into a couple new countries, and splitting Saudi Arabia into three new countries. And you'd have an Arab Shia state along the Persian Gulf. So we would control the oil, and they would control the holy cities. That's a fair deal, right? This map caused incredible outrage in the Middle East because that is essentially the U.S. war plan. It's also worth noting that all of the existing borders in this region were drawn by the French and the British, most of them in 1920, and there were no Arabs invited to the discussions to do that. Probably about every Arab over about the age of five knows this. It's also worth noting that the largest population of Arab people is along the Nile in Egypt, and yet the oil is all over here in these countries that most of them don't even have a million people each. So you have western lines that separate the bulk of the Arabs from the bulk of the wealth. In the desert, where water is, controls where food can grow. The control of the oil is not about making more money for people who already have too much. It's about controlling the global economy. And in Israel, the control of the aquifers is probably more important than religious difference. And since we're in Washington, I just have to acknowledge the courage of Rachel Corrie of Olympia, Washington, and the double standards of the guy in Tiananmen Square standing in front of the tank and Rachel Corrie standing in front of the bulldozer. Skip over this. That's just other than say part of what happened in Sudan with South Sudan being split off is the oils mostly in South Sudan. So we've heard for decades that it's time that we end foreign oil dependence. And now we need to add Obama to the graphic and maybe Mr. Romney if he gets the job. But since what is left is in the Islamic part of the world for the most part, it's pretty unlikely we're going to be energy independent. This is from Oil Creek State Park in Pennsylvania, where the world's first oil well was drilled in 1859. It's a museum now. And if you go hiking in the trails in the park, you can come across all sorts of rusting oil equipment from the late 1800s. But even more impressive is Pit Hole City, which was a boom town not far from there, established in 1865, a ghost town by 1868. I think that's a record. They tapped into an oil deposit. They had a town, and you walk there now, you can't even tell there was a town. If it wasn't for the sign, you'd have no idea. So oil production or extraction in the U.S. peaked in 1970, just as M. King Hubbert predicted in 1956 it would. And this doesn't show the recent fracking for shale gas, but it's not changed the curve substantially. This white area right here would be the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. All it would do is just change the shape on the downslope. The dark right here is Alaska. And for a close-up of Alaska, Alaskan oil started in 1977. It peaked at about 2.5 million barrels a day in 1988. It's now down to, this year, 562,000 barrels a day, or about the same it was in the initial startup. Below 500,000 barrels a day, they're not sure they can keep it flowing in the Arctic winter. And the reason that's important, this is Puget Sound. There are 5 refineries in Puget Sound, BP up near the border, and another one here, 2 in Anacortes, and 1 down in Tacoma. That's where Washington and Oregon get almost every drop of oil that we use in both states. Not just for cars, but food delivery trucks, Amtrak, airports, etc.
Is it because they won't be able to fill the pipe with enough oil?
It gets a little bit chilly on the Arctic slope. They have to keep it above 38 Fahrenheit. And when it gets into low flow condition, they're concerned they won't be able to do that anymore. They're doing all sorts of technical tricks to see if they can keep the flow going down to 300,000 barrels. If you go to the Alaska Pipeline website, there's a report called the Low Flow Study, which is actually written in, it's not that technical to read. My guess is somewhere between 5 and 15 years from now, that will be over. I wouldn't set your clock by that, but the only question is when. So we hear a lot about offshore drilling, which I think is done on a swift boat. The bulk of the offshore drilling that's been done for 40 years is off the coast of Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, right in the path of hurricanes. When Obama expanded the area for offshore drilling, about 2 years ago now, he did it in an area that doesn't really have offshore oil to drill. The only offshore oil drilling area that actually has substantial amount, because what this is undiscovered technically recoverable resources, which means they might exist, and if they did, we might be able to get them, but we don't actually know that they really do exist. Off the coast of Southern California near Santa Barbara, there's actually offshore oil that is worth drilling, and they don't drill it anymore offshore because there was a spill that was a bit controversial. So the reason we're drilling for oil in a mile of water is onshore, the good oil is gone. The days where you can stick a pipe in the ground and have a waterfall of oil come out are long gone. In Oregon, a couple years ago, the state of Oregon passed a moratorium on offshore drilling, which the environmental groups championed. Except there isn't any oil on the Oregon coast. Doesn't matter if you praise it or protest it. Because our geology in the Northwest is a subduction zone. Whatever pockets of fossil algae were off the coast long ago got subducted under the continents and out Mount St. Helens or the other volcanoes. So we don't have any petroleum. There have been a couple environmental groups, such as Earth Island Journal, which have talked about the need for an environmental approach to peak oil. But most of the environmental groups are AWOL. Peak oil is not an activist cause, not just because it's not discussed by the activists, but because addressing it is a civilization-wide shift, not a political campaign. Tar sands. The only thing to say about tar sands, other than the obvious, is this gray right here shows tar sands through 2030. And if we don't want the evil of tar sands, we're going to have a faster decline of the oil economy. That's the price for canceling tar sands. We also have peak electricity. In North America, we have four main electric grids. Curiously, Texas is its own grid, as is Quebec. You have the Western grid, which stretches from Canada to Tijuana to Denver, and the Eastern grid, which is the rest of the country. And it all vibrates together at 60 times a second. I think peak electricity was March 11, 2011, with the explosion of Fukushima. We have peak uranium. Half of the uranium used for nuclear power in the United States right now comes from megatons to megawatts, a program that is recycling Russian nuclear weapon material into electricity, which ends next year. Coal has also peaked. This is peak coal in Pennsylvania. This is 1920. 1920 was the peak of coal in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is where the coal industry started. In Britain, peak coal was 1913. The last time this production was this low, Napoleon was alive. Of course, we're being told that there's such a thing as clean coal, and I'm sure most people have seen pictures of flattened mountains in Appalachia. Last year, I went on a tour with the South Wings organization in Southwest Virginia in this little plane, and we saw what used to be mountains. And it's one thing to see pictures of it, but to see it in person and to smell it in person is really something. The whole area from here into Kentucky stank. You could smell the destruction. And this is a coal burner that opened up in July of this year, right next to where we were looking at from the airplane. And this coal burner is completely surrounded by mountaintop removal. But it's going to be clean coal because they have better filters, and they're going to throw truckloads of trees into the burner. So we also have fracking for shale gas, which is a big concern in Texas and Pennsylvania and New York. Onshore conventional natural gas is expected to drop dramatically by 2020, and shale gas will supposedly come to the rescue. There's a geologist named Art Berman, and the New York Times actually did a profile of him, which I was pleasantly surprised to see. He looked at the different gas companies and compared what their estimates were of how much they have versus what he thinks they really do have. And he concluded that instead of having 100 years of natural gas from fracking, the correct figure is probably 7. So it's not just that fracking is toxic and destroys aquifers, it's also been wildly oversold. So when you hear politicians like Obama say we have 100 years of natural gas, it's not just that it's toxic, they're also lying about the supply, which is one of the reasons we have doubled our import of liquid natural gas over the last decade. These boats are at the temperature of Saturn, because that's what you have to do to get natural gas to liquefy. Propane liquefies at room temperature. But these boats are incredibly dangerous. There's been a couple ports on the West Coast that have stopped it. San Francisco Bay stopped a proposal. Humboldt County stopped a proposal. So they built it in Baja California across the line, and they're pumping it across the border to California for electricity. There's a cordon of about a kilometer radius around it that Homeland Security sets up, because if there's an explosion, it's like a small nuclear weapon going off. So most people think oil is about cars, and I guess it is. This is from the 2005 highway bill These are all the new and expanded superhighways planned across the United States. In Washington State, there is a proposal for what's called the Washington Commerce Corridor, which is this white line. It would be a giant super bypass of the main cities of Puget Sound. And the model that they proposed for it is what is similar to what's being proposed in Texas, where you have car lanes, truck lanes, utility corridors, freight lines, high-speed passenger rail, electricity, water, petroleum, natural gas, maybe bulk salsa too. That's a joke. But a quarter mile wide swath. The only thing that's really held this up is there's no money for it. In Tacoma, a couple years ago, there was a new interstate highway that was approved by the state and the feds for $2 billion. But they don't even have the money to maintain what they already have. The NAFTA superhighway proposal, some people think it's one highway, and it would connect ports on the Pacific coast in Mexico, because the ports in the U.S. are overloaded with all the cheap crap coming in from China. So this would be building extra port capacity and bringing it all up to the Walmarts of Indiana and so forth. But it's multiple corridors. You have east, central, west. But just like with peak oil, we also have peak traffic. And as the price of oil has gone up, vehicle miles traveled has plateaued. There's still a lot of traffic, but it's not going up and up anymore. This is from Oregon, showing vehicle miles traveled since 1970. You can see the 73 oil embargo here, 79 recession, and then it went back up again for a while, but it's been in a plateau for about a decade. Highway law in the United States assumes you have to plan for 20 years in the future, not for current traffic. So what's the traffic going to be in 2030, 2035? It's not going to be continual growth. Now, I'm a big fan of Amtrak. I've taken it all over the country. I have an Amtrak frequent rider card. In fact, about the only thing that Obama's people have done that I really like is they gave nice words about Amtrak and then forgot to follow through on any of them. But this is the Acela train on the East Coast, which goes 150 miles an hour. It's our only real high-speed train in America. You have the Amtrak Cascades here that runs up and down from Vancouver to Eugene. It can go 120 miles an hour, 200 kilometers an hour, but the tracks can't handle it. And this is an initial proposal from U.S. Department of Transportation for higher speed rail around the country, but we spent the resources to destroy Iraq. One way you can tell we're not serious about transportation is when, after the 73 oil embargo, the Nixon administration rolled back the speed limit to 55, we could save more oil overnight doing that now than flows through the Alaska pipeline without having to change any technology other than some science. There's no need to worry about petroleum reserves. Our latest sports utility vehicle comes equipped with its own drilling rig. We're praying for lower gas prices. I'm praying for a sane response to the fact the Earth is round and therefore not infinite. And of course, if you're praying, who are you praying to? Because Allah was more generous than Jesus. Land use is, of course, a big part of transportation demand. The further people live away from an urban core, generally the more oil they use. Lower vehicle miles traveled, higher vehicle miles traveled. This is Eugene and Springfield. But a more integrated approach to intelligent urban design would be to recognize that urban, suburban, and rural areas each have things they excel at and things they don't. Urban dwellers have better access to public transit, walking, bicycling, but they're also the least able to feed themselves. And in theory, rural areas have the best potential for feeding themselves, but are most dependent on oil for transportation. And the deeper reality is people already live in all these places. We have to convert each of them. We need to convert suburban lawns. We need to make cities better for transit. We need to make rural areas more energy independent. And all of these places are all dependent on each other. And it creates some hostility, because when you have the food coming from rural areas and the rural people don't like the city slickers and vice versa, there's a huge amount of tension. And this is basically the political divide in the United States. Urban areas vote Democrat, rural areas vote Republican. The older suburbs generally vote Democrat. The newer suburbs generally vote Republican. That's an oversimplification, but it's true. And there's all sorts of short-term things we could do. This is from Saving Oil in a Hurry from the International Energy Agency for the different industrial countries. And in the United States, they found that carpooling would actually have more impact than making public transit free. Whereas in Europe, it's the other way around. Biomass. This is the decline of virgin forest in the United States. There's not much left. So we are now burning trees to make electricity too, which can be a nice idea on a very small scale level, but the electric grid is insatiable for this. We have a new one in Eugene that opened up about 2 years ago. And the timber companies have large areas of tiny trees, new forest planted 2000. And on here, the white and the red shows areas of forest that are less than 20 years old. Most of the industrial forest lands in the Northwest are very young. And the timber company has lost its market for building condos. This is a sign from Las Vegas that says, two homes for the price of one. Doesn't say if drinking water comes with it. This is from Port Townsend Air Watchers, which shows sourcing in each of the forest biomass incinerators planned for the Olympic Peninsula, or in some cases already in operation. But it's actually misleading because the blue is ocean, where you can't source, and in here is the national park where you can't source, at least for now. So there's going to be incredible competition to cut the same trees. We had a conference in Eugene called Clear Cutting the Climate 4 years ago, and one of the presenters from Oregon State showed how when you convert an old growth forest to a rotational tree farm, you permanently put carbon into the atmosphere. Does money grow on trees? The rise in the economy mirrors the rise of oil production. On the downslope, it's going to be more like financial climate change rather than a recession. Money is one of the most mysterious things. We all use it, but few think about how it is created. Money is loaned into existence based on debt and compound interest. This works as the total economy keeps getting bigger, but on the energy downslope, the monetary system cannot function properly anymore. And this is essentially the root of the financial crisis. It's not just Wall Street greed. The real issue of peak oil is not personal transportation, but the risk to the food supply. Peak grain per capita in the world happened a quarter century ago. Even organic food is usually transported long distance and packaged with petroleum-based plastics. Eating Fossil Fuels by Dale Allen Pfeiffer. And that leads to peak population. And dieoff.org is not a happy site, but it is one of the two websites about peak oil before 9/11. And a lot of it is focused on economics. In nature, when there's overshoot, this is the model that overshoot usually follows. This was a reindeer herd introduced to an island in Alaska that didn't have any predators. And they ate, and they ate, and they ate, and they ate all the food on the island, and then they crashed. Now, Hollywood has been selling us this for several decades. Mad Max, Soylent Green. That's certainly a possibility. But I think one of the most important tasks for the permaculture movement is to come up with a different narrative than these. And the acting is really bad in them. Livestock eat 94% of North Dakota soybean meal. So there's obviously some room to shift the way the agriculture system works. This is from the train station, actually. Here's a freeway ramp in San Francisco that was turned into an urban farm, the Hayes Valley Farm. Here's a organic gardening class being offered in a park in the middle of Chicago. But you also have the McDonald's and Rainforest Cafe with a slightly bigger budget. And you can't see this in the graphic, but this is a skyscraper being built where the apartments are only going for $7 million.
Yeah,
So the scale of the sane response is tiny compared to the dominant paradigm. During World War II, the government promoted victory gardens. But for the war on terror, they just want us to continue mindless shopping. Now, if we had a government, media, corporations, and educational system focused on survival, we might see some updated versions of this. And I suspect most people here have a garden that's larger than the demonstration garden that's now on the White House lawn. Now, it's nice there's a garden on the White House lawn, but it was just done as a little hint saying, hey, if you're paying attention, we need to do this. We need full-scale, system-wide shift. Now, I was born the day after this, and I just have a two-minute clip when a president did have the courage to say a shift that we need. Today we have reached a pause in the Cold War. If both sides can gain new confidence and experience and concrete collaborations, sorry about that.
The United Nations 18th General Assembly, which opened in an unusually hopeful atmosphere, hears a message of interplanetary importance from President Kennedy, who arrives with Ambassador Adlai Stevenson. Mr. Kennedy is welcomed by Secretary General U Thant and American delegate Dr. Ralph Bunche. He is the first of many chiefs of state who are scheduled to address the assembly. The probable next is Marshal Tito of Yugoslavia. Mr. Kennedy hails the pause in the Cold War while taking note of Cuba and Berlin. Then he makes a startling proposal.
Finally, in a field where the United States and the Soviet Union have a special capacity, in the field of space, there is room for new cooperation, for further joint efforts in the regulation and exploration of space. I include among these possibilities a joint expedition to the moon. Space offers no problems of sovereignty. By resolution of this assembly, the members of the United Nations have forsworn any claim to territorial rights in outer space or on celestial bodies, and declare that international law and the United Nations Charter will apply. Why, therefore, should man's first flight to the moon be a matter of national competition? Why should the United States and the Soviet Union, in preparing for such expedition, become involved in immense duplications of research, construction, and expenditure?
So imagine what would have happened if we had left the Earth flag instead of that other thing on the moon. The aliens in 3 million years would be confused if they see the American flag, but if we leave the Earth flag, they would know who had been there. Now, if you go in the National Shrine for the Space Program, the Air and Space Museum in Washington, there is no mention whatsoever of this change. Although the docent, the museum curator I talked with when I was there, knew all about it. This month is the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I highly recommend the movies 13 Days and, to a lesser extent, The Fog of War, which discuss this. 13 Days is a dramatic reenactment. And I give thanks that Kennedy refused to listen to the generals, because I was born in New York City, across town from where he gave the speech, and there would be no New York City today. There would be no Seattle. What the world would be like if we had invaded Cuba in 62 is anyone's guess, but we probably would not be here. And of course, we all know what happened 2 months later. John Kennedy was removed from office. And the political autopsy on the United States of America needs to start here. There's a lot of discussion about the need for hope, which is important. But what we need even more is courage to face our collective predicament. Looking at the full scope of these problems is needed for effective responses. Down the road from here is, of course, the West Coast Trident missile base, which would not exist if we had called off the Cold War in the 1960s. We need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, like in South Africa, for the U.S. Empire. And it's not about vindictiveness or prosecution or being partisan. It's about understanding what has been done in our name, and that we have let this happen in our name, and that the resources for permanent war need to be shifted for our cooperative survival. In the 1990s, there was a project in Arizona called Biosphere, which was designing a domed city that would be self-sufficient. And it didn't work because the biosphere needs to be 8,000 miles in diameter. That's the only system that really works. And we're trying to make it not work anymore. So the billionaires are not going to be able to hide in a bunker while the rest of us die. But the billionaires aren't going to make it if we don't. And we're probably not going to make it if the billionaires don't. Although they might have to share their resources a bit. But we're all in the same boat. The financial system that requires endless growth on a finite planet is one of the root things that has to shift for us to survive what we have created. For example, if Weyerhaeuser, which is a publicly traded corporation, wants to shift to sustainable forestry, they cannot do it because they would have to give up some of their short-term profit in order to have long-term benefit, and their shareholders could sue them for the failure to meet the fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders. Steady-state economies need to be implemented in order to have a steady-state future. Steady-state economics parallels the working of an old-growth forest, where growth and decay are in balance. And to conclude, R. Crumb, the artist, came up with these excellent cartoons showing three potential futures. The first two are ecological disaster, and the fun, techno-fix future, which I think are the same. And the third is the ecotopian solution, which is technically possible. The only obstacle is psychology. So we're in a cultural emergency. And it's confusing that things are getting better and worse at the same time. We have the potential to convert the military-industrial complex, to redirect the financial system, to use the tremendous talents we've developed in civilization toward actual sustainability. I'll close with another excerpt from Kennedy's United Nations speech. Quote, "Never before has man had such capacity to control his own environment, to end thirst and hunger, to conquer poverty and disease, to banish illiteracy and massive human misery. We have the power to make this the best generation of mankind in the history of the world, or to make it the last." Thank you for the opportunity to present these paradigms and for your concern and attention.